Welcome to another edition of the Exponential Podcast. I'm Todd Wilson, Director of Exponential. We're thrilled you're taking advantage of this free resource that was recorded at the Exponential Conference. It's part of a library of hundreds of hours of free training. In our mission to equip church planning leaders, we seek to distribute as many free resources as possible. Visit exponential.org to learn more and to check out the programming for the upcoming Exponential Conference.
Well, folks, we'll get started. I'm assuming this mic is for recording purposes, so we'll keep it close so we can do that. Hey, just to make sure you're in the right place, this is Leading a Great Team, and I'm Joby Martin. I'm the lead pastor of the Church of 1122, and I'm not even like a real church planner. I'm kind of an accidental church planner. I didn't really mean to do this. How many of you have not planted yet? You intend on planting a church? All right, you can always tell because they have hope, and that kind of desire in their eyes, and everybody else has planted. You're kind of in the throes of it. All right, so you can always see like Red Bull and despair in the eyes of those guys. So I was a youth pastor. Thought I'd be a youth guy forever and ever. Didn't even intend to go into ministry. The first sermon I ever preached, I was at a youth camp, and I was standing kind of in the back of the room, and my football coach ran the youth camp, and this was before, like, Chris Tomlin and Louis Giglio invented worship, and we were singing, like, I am a C, I'm a C-H. Remember those songs? I'm a C-H-R-E-S-T-I-N. Now, I'm from Dillon, South Carolina, so I was about in the 10th grade before I realized we were spelling Christian. You know, I thought we were speaking in tongues. I was like, I thought we were Baptists. I didn't know we spoke in tongues. This is great. And so during the singing, he was like, all right, Joby Martin, you're up. You're going to preach. And I was like, preach? Like in 2 minutes when I'm a C's over? And he's like, yeah. And I said, coach, I'm not really comfortable speaking in public. And he said, comfortable? Did you say comfortable? You think Daniel was comfortable in the lion's den? Do you think Paul and Silas were comfortable in prison? Do you think Jesus Christ was comfortable on the cross? And I was like, no, sir. And I said, well, what do I talk about? And he said, boy, that's easy. You talk about Jesus, you talk about 30 minutes. Go. And so that's what I did. And then here I am, you know, one event leads to another, and now I'm the lead pastor of the Church of 1122. Again, we totally planted by accident. We started, I thought I'd be a youth guy forever. We started a service at the church that I was working at, and then that service outgrew the whole church. And so then the senior pastor that I worked for there is the best Christian that I've ever met in my entire life. And I was working at a United Methodist church, even though I'm not United Methodist at all. 1122 is an Acts 29 church, and so I think the Wesley brothers and Calvin all rolled over in their grave when that happened, but it happened. And so we planted, and they let us sort of stay under the umbrella of that local church for a year while we were raising money and finding a building and renovating and moving in. And so so we found an old Walmart in our town that had been abandoned, looked like the end of a Terminator 2 movie. You know, it was kind of nasty, and a new Walmart doesn't smell awesome. An abandoned one, you know, it's kind of rough. And so we did the whole thing. And again, man, I'm just an overeducated redneck from a little place called Dillon, South Carolina. And my daddy always says the best thing ever come out of Dillon is I-95. And he is right. And so when I called him and said, hey, Daddy, we're going to put our church in a Walmart, he said, boy, I'm so proud of you. I always thought you'd work at Walmart. And so so that's a little bit of who I am. And so somehow over the years, we planted our church 3.5 years ago, and it has grown pretty quickly. And what's crazy is I did seminary and all those things, and we spent a whole lot of time talking about Greek and Hebrew and parsing verbs and who was king during what era and all of that stuff, which is vitally important, although you can get it all on Logos now for a lot cheaper. You can go to school. But they taught very little on leadership, very little on leadership. And yet the majority of what I do is lead teams throughout my week. And so we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about what it's like to lead a great team. And I don't really have any original ideas, and I don't know that I have very good ideas. I just have to unpack it out of the scriptures. And so if you've got your Bible, let's go to Matthew chapter 20. And I would give you a warning. If somebody stands in front of you with great ideas and no Bible, get your things, go to the door, and find a new place to listen. So Matthew chapter 20. I think there's a, I don't know if it, what it, a recipe might be the right word. There's a recipe for great leadership, and you're going to see here at the end that Jesus redefines what greatness means. And so I think there's at least four observations from Matthew 17 to 28 that I just want to spend a few minutes on, and then I'll try to leave some time for questions at the end. Matthew 20:17. And as Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside. And on the way, he said to them, "See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified, and he will be raised on the third day." Now, when a lot of people teach on this text, they start in verse 20 and they skip 17, 18, and 19. And the thing that I want you to see here is before we ever get into what it takes to lead a great team, you can't lose sight of the gospel. The gospel is your source of power for all the leadership opportunity that God will give you. And you are going to be leading to the gospel and from the gospel and with the gospel. And the first thing has to be that all of your leadership is gospel saturated. That Jesus is the greatest leader to ever live. And it is that gospel, the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus that puts you in a place of leadership. Because what a lot of us will be tempted to do is try to justify ourselves by our leadership mantle that we have been given. And what we have to understand here in the gospel is that our justification is not in our imperfect works as a leader. But our justification is in the perfect work of Jesus on the cross. And I know what some of you are doing right now. You're like, "Listen, I'm varsity. I'm planting a church. I don't need a review of the gospel." Warning, warning, warning. Don't ever move away from the gospel. What we're going to see here in the very next verse is that the mother of the sons of Zebedee takes her eyes off of the gospel. I mean, she's like, "Okay, yeah, you're going to, you know, live and die and be resurrected. But I got some important stuff to talk about. Can we talk about the positional authority of my two boys?" And I see this happen in church all the time. People are like, yeah, I know Christ laid down his life for us, but I got to get VBS done. That's what I'm talking about here. And so let me highly encourage you to not lose sight of the gospel, because you will lose the power source by which you have been handed the authority to be in leadership. And so with that in mind, the mom does exactly what I'm warning us against. She loses sight of the gospel, but I think we can learn some things from this interaction. Verse 20 through 28. It says, "Then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came up to him with her sons, and kneeling before him," that may be important, "she asked for something. And he said to her, 'What do you want?' And she said to him, 'Say that these two sons of mine are to sit, one at your right and one at your left, in your kingdom.' And Jesus answered, 'You don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink?' And they said to him, 'We are able.' And he said to them, 'You will drink my cup, but to sit at my right hand and at my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father.' And when the 10 heard it, they were indignant at the two brothers. But Jesus called them to him and said, 'You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. It shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be your slave, even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many.'" So, four observations that I would say could be maybe recipes for how to be a great leader and how to lead a great team. And the first is, it's a part of this that you just have to understand, great teams are led by great leaders. I need you to give me a little bit of hermeneutical license, because the mom has wrong motives, but what you'll see here is she has the right posture. You see, she comes to Jesus and she kneels before Jesus. And the question that she asked of her sons is that they could sit at his right hand and left hand. So the first thing I would say is this: if you're going to lead a great team and be a great leader, you got to know how to rest. You got to know how to rest. You've got to know how to kneel before Jesus. And you have to understand that rest is found in him. Now, I know as a leader, like, I don't wake up every morning trying to think about when I'm going to get to rest. All right. Rarely. And what we have to understand is that this nature of Sabbath, this nature of rest being found in Christ, is to fuel us for what we're going to do. It's not a reward for what we have done. If you think about when Adam and Eve were first created, the very first thing they did on their first day was Sabbath. I mean, they were created on the sixth day, and on the seventh day, they rest. Why? Was it because they were tired? No, they haven't done anything yet. All they've done is be created and be in this relationship with God. And that rest is not a result of working hard. It's preparation so you can do everything God has called you to do. And I'm just going to guess that most of you, especially if you're at a church, if you're a church planner, you're probably not a very good rester. And it'll kill you. I mean, the reality is you will kneel at Jesus' feet or you will kneel at Jesus' feet. Those are your two options. You will take time off or you will take time off. You will humble yourself or you will be humbled. Those just are your options. And, you know, a lot of Jewish rabbis would say that the fourth commandment, which is still a commandment, by the way, to honor the Sabbath and keep it holy. And I know the only people that pay attention to that are like Chick-fil-A and Hobby Lobby, right? And don't you curse them on a Sunday. You drive by like, oh, man, look at the line at Chick-fil-A. It's so short. And then you pull in, you're like, ah, Sabbath. And so it's just true. But the fourth commandment was the hinge commandment. The first three commandments were vertical commandments, and commandments 5 through 10 were all horizontal commandments. Jesus sort of summed it up this way. The greatest commandment is love God and love people. But there was one right there in the middle, the Sabbath rest commandment. And the point of that is not just to take a nap and, you know, watch the Masters on television. But the point of that was so that you would reconnect and refuel with the Lord so that you would love Him to the point and He would love you to the point that you could do commandments 5 through 10. I think part of the reason maybe the gospel is here in the beginning is because your rest comes in the gospel. Like, just maybe you jot this down when you're feeling the pressure in your church plant. The performance trap is over. The performance trap is over. When Jesus pushed up on those nail-pierced feet on the cross and He says, "It is finished," that counted for you. That counted for you. That means that your identity is not wrapped up in how well your church plant goes. And let me just tell you, here at Exponential, I love this conference. I love Ferguson and Todd and all the guys that put this thing together. But your church plant is probably not going to go like the guys they put up on stage. Like, it's just not. You're not Chandler. I mean, it's not going to go that way. You're probably not going to plant a church and 10,000 people just show up and carry you off the field chanting Rudy. It's just not going to. And even if it does, then your identity is not wrapped up in that either. And so rest comes from understanding the gospel. If you use your ministry to validate you before Jesus, you will die under that weight. Ministry makes a terrible God, a terrible God. And one of the worst things that you can do is begin to chase the numbers. Do you know why? Because they will forever change. It is crazy. The attendance numbers that used to make me turn cartwheels now make me want to slip my wrist. I mean, that it's crazy. And so if you chase after those things, essentially, what you're doing is declaring that what Christ did on the cross for us is not enough to provide the peace and rest that He promised. Now, one of my favorite seminary professors, when I graduated, the day I graduated, he said this. You've probably heard this before. He said, if the devil can't make you bad, he'll make you busy. If the devil can't make you bad, he'll make you busy. back in the day when I was a youth pastor, I was at one of these kind of things, and Doug Fields was teaching. He was one of my mentors kind of coming through ministry. He was kind of the pope of youth ministry back in the day. He probably still is. And he was just encouraging pastors to take a day off, take a day off, take a day off. And then in the back of the room, this older guy raises his hand and says, "Well, I don't take a day off because the devil doesn't take a day off." And then Doug immediately went, "Well, he's not my role model," which is just so true, right? So here's a couple things about rested pastors. One, pace is a myth. Pace is a myth. It's run, sprint, rest. Rhythm is way more important than pace. I would highly encourage you, don't run at an average speed for the rest of your days in ministry. There are seasons in your ministry where you run to the point of utter exhaustion, and then you take a break and rest. And you need to think through daily rhythms. You need to think through weekly rhythms. You need to think through monthly rhythms and yearly rhythms. And fellas, your wife needs to help you understand that, because you are not a great evaluator of your own rhythms. You're not. And here's why. You think you're awesome. She knows you're not that awesome. Okay. here's why you let her just highly influence you, because nobody knows you like she does, nobody loves you like she does, and no one is less impressed with you than she is. And those things are just true. So not pace, think rhythm. Secondly, you got to eat well. You got to eat well. Jesus said that we are to love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the way that we eat and take care of ourselves matters. You got to sleep enough. You got to sleep enough. I've got one of my elders requires me to turn in my sleep hours to him. And he requires me. And if I don't sleep enough, then I get in trouble. Rested people in ministry love their spouses. They love their spouses. And I can tell you, you'll really be clicking on all cylinders when you're doing ministry together. And I mean really together, whatever those roles look like. But the closest you can be, man, is when you're running that race together and you're running it side by side. And it's not, there's not this false dichotomy between church and family. That God has called you into this ministry, and you should have no greater expectation of your spouse in ministry than you would any other committed believer in your church. And let them find their place in ministry, but to have a real ministry on their own. And hopefully at this point in church history, we've heard enough about churches being mistresses and those kinds of things, that you are focusing on your spouse. You should have regular date nights. You should be checking in often. Rested ministers, they love their children well. They love their children well. There are multiple times in our church calendar where I just have to say no to an event at church because I'm saying yes to one of my children. So just recently, my son plays Little League Baseball, and he had an all-star game on a Wednesday night. And those things are on the schedule for a long, long time. And we had a funeral at our church. It was kind of a big deal. It was a teenager at our church got hit by a car. And so when we found out that they were scheduled at the same time, and I just, you know, I told the folks I can't be there. And there are some people that kind of freak out about there. They're like, what? What do you mean? I mean, you're the pastor of this church. Don't you think you need to be there? And I said, listen, here's the reality. There will be a lot of pastors at that funeral tonight from our church. My son, JP, he only has one dad. I'm the only one that can play that role at that ball game. So I'm going to be at the ball game. So you got to love your kids well. This is a big one. You have to have actual friends. I mean, like actual friends, people that you like, people that you hang out with, people that you can talk about things with that don't have to do with you and your ministry. And this is a big one. You need to have a life outside of church. I mean, what are you into that's not your ministry? I would highly encourage you. I've been in ministry for 22 years or something. I know it looks like I started when I was 13. And I would highly encourage you to be obsessed with something that's healthy outside of church. I mean, it could be whatever, movies, golf. I hunt a lot. I write every sermon in a tree stand. It's a part of what helps me get in the right rhythm. You know, I preach my guts out on Sunday, then Monday morning I'm hunting. Right now it's turkey season, so I would be turkey hunting normally on a Monday. And nobody can get to me. They can't get to my cell phone. I pray better in the woods. All of those things happen. My wife tells me I like you better when you're coming home from the woods. It's just better. And I can get there in a second. If any of you after this want to talk about hunting, let's talk, man. Especially if you're from like Illinois and you want to invite me to come to your place, I'm with you. And so it takes me just a second for my mind to go all, you know, chasing around animals in the woods and forget about church. It is vitally important that you find something to be obsessed with that's not church. It will save you, to help you get into rhythm. And then also, let me just say this, especially you fellas, if you're married and have kids, you get one hobby. You just get one hobby. So choose wisely. When you were single, you know, you could do whatever. And then you get married and you got to narrow it down. When you have kids, you get one hobby. Choose wisely. Make sure it's healthy and something that can sort of steal your mind away from church. So the first thing is this. To be a great leader and lead great teams, you have to find your rest in the gospel. And again, you will create who you are. And so if you worship at the idol of work, then expect everybody else on your team to. And then the ones that don't have the capacity that you do, they'll be burning out like crazy, and it's actually your fault. It's your responsibility. According to Hebrews 13, there will be a day where you will stand and give an account for the souls of the people that God put under your care. And if the people under you are burning out because you are modeling and demonstrating that you are worshiping at the idol of work, then that is your responsibility. Secondly, if you want to be a great leader, you've got to have the ability to endure pain. The ability to endure pain. Now, nobody really wants to talk about this, but it's just true. Nobody wants to talk about it when they're in it. They like to talk about it when it happened 3 or 4 years ago. Here's what Jesus says in verse 22. Jesus answered, "You don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink?" And they said to him, "We are able." And you know that the cup that he is talking about is to endure the wrath of God. That in the Garden of Gethsemane, he says, "Father, if there be any other way, let this cup," which represented his wrath, "let this cup pass from me. Not my will, but thy will be done." If you are going to go into ministry, then you will experience pain. And I'm not sure why people are so surprised by this. 1 Peter chapter 5, when Peter's talking to the elders, he says, "And you will suffer for a little while. And when the suffering is finished," I mean, that's the promise. You know, we love to talk about the promises of God, don't we? But we never like to talk about those promises. I want to do a calendar that has the promises of God, like, "You will endure pain," right? "Suffering is coming your way. This is going to suck for a minute." I mean, those kind of things, all right? That was the Message remix, that last one. Some of you read that. So, and the reality is that the level of leadership that you were able to attain is proportionate to the pain that you can endure. The level of leadership that you were able to attain is proportionate, directly proportionate to the pain that you can endure. And I've had some guys push back on me on that, but man, I don't know about that. Where do you find in the scriptures that the level of pain you can endure is proportionate to the leadership mantle that God will give you? I don't know, Moses, you know, start there. It's kind of a painful life, right? Or how about we just jump right to the end? Jesus, he's a pretty good leader. He endured the ultimate excruciating pain of the cross, and all authority in heaven and earth were put under him. And so, if you haven't planted yet, and you think planting a church is just going to be fun, I'm not saying there's not some fun things to it. Man, it is. It's super awesome. In fact, I think we're spoiled like crazy as Americans, you know? I mean, to just be able to show up to a conference and to say you're a church planter in your town, and right now that's a pretty cool thing. I mean, if you're in evangelical world and you say you're a church planter, people are like, "Man, you're the cutting edge, front line. How awesome is that?" And there's magazines about you. That's crazy, isn't it? Right? There are brothers and sisters in our world right now, and they are just hiding out, trying not to get their head sawed off on YouTube, literally today. So when we talk about pain, it is very relative compared to what others are going through around the world. But man, you plant a church, you've got to be able to endure pain. Philippians 3, 10 and 11, Paul says that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and may share his sufferings, becoming like him in his death, that by any means possible. That's a pretty big deal, right? That by any means possible, I may attain the resurrection from the dead. And you might be like, "What are you saying, Paul? Are you saying you have to do something to earn that?" Well, come on. The brother wrote Romans. He kind of gets the gospel, right? But he's saying, "I am willing to do whatever it is, to be whipped, to be shipwrecked, to be snake bitten, to live as Christ, to die as gain. Whatever it takes, that I may attain the resurrection from the dead." One of the things, one of the little kitschy cliches that Christians always love to say is, "God, just make us the hands and feet of Jesus. Just make us the hands and feet of Jesus," right? Do you remember what happened to the hands and feet of Jesus? They weren't like petting sheep and playing, singing kumbaya with kids. I mean, they did that for a minute, and then nails were driven through it. So if you're going to be the church, and you're going to be the hands and feet of Jesus, then get ready, because the pain is coming. And let me just tell you, if you want a pain-free life, do not go into ministry. Like, get out now. You can still get out, all right? I don't think Ferguson will give you your money back from here, but it's worth it, all right? There are times, there's a Chick-fil-A on the way home from between our church and where I live, and occasionally they'll put a little now hiring sign up. And I'll be driving by that Chick-fil-A, and I think, man, I wonder what it's like to work at Chick-fil-A. I mean, it's pretty Christian, so that's awesome, right? And I bet nobody calls you in the middle of the night and is like, oh my goodness, we have a problem. We can't find the biscuit mix. What shall we do? I think when you clock out from Chick-fil-A, you're just actually done, you know? And sometimes I dream of that. I mean, I just ride by thinking, wow, that must be amazing, an amazing job. And yet, if that's what you're going for, if you want pain-free, then do not go into ministry. Chuck Swindoll says it this way. When God has an impossible task to accomplish, he finds an impossible person and crushes them. So leave room in your life for the crushing. In every great work of God, brokenness and failure are necessary. I'm going to read it again. I wish I could make up stuff like that. When God has an impossible task to accomplish, he finds an impossible person and he crushes them. So leave room in your life for the crushing. In every great work of God, brokenness and failure are necessary. Now, let me just, I got a little confession for you. I came to Expo before we launched our church, like in 2011. And every single person that got up to speak was saying similar things that I'm saying now, about how hard it is and tough it is on your family and tough it is on your physical health and the toll that planting a church will take on you mentally and financially, etc. And I'm sitting in the back, and I was just that ticked off youth pastor. That was my MO, all right? For about 15 years, I was the youth pastor that knew everything, was responsible for nothing. You know how they are. I was. And so just kind of sit in the back of rooms and be critical of everything that was happening. So I'd be at my church, and they would sing some lame song, and I'd be like, that song's so lame. I would never do that. I'm sorry. And they would show some stupid video or, you know, just all that stuff. And I was like, man, if I was in charge, I'd do this, that, and the other. And the Lord went, all right, Scooter, your turn, all right? And so I didn't know anything about church planting. I didn't even know it was a thing because we were kind of in student ministry world. And so I Googled church planting when I realized that we were going to plant out of the church I was at. And Expo came up, and it was 2 hours away, and I was like, maybe we should go here. I was like, holy crap, there's a lot of people that do this. This is crazy. And so every guy gets up and talks about how difficult it is, and I'm sitting in the back with my middle school guy. And I leaned over, and I was like, man, these guys are – wimpy is what I'll translate it to. But, you know, I'm like, why is everybody complaining? I mean, how hard can it be, right? So you fast forward about a year and a half, and we are planting our church, and we're just a couple of weeks away from opening up and having our very first service as the Church of 1122. And I would wake up in the morning, and it would feel like an elephant sitting on my chest. And I'm a relatively healthy guy and have always been healthy. And so I'm driving into the office that day, and my wife used to work in physical therapy, and I get to the parking lot, and I almost feel like I can't breathe. I mean, so I just called her up. I'm like, hey, babe, don't freak out, but I've got a question, which is a terrible way to start any conversation, isn't it? And so I just said, so don't freak out, but what's a heart attack feel like? And she's like, what? I'm like, yeah, well, it could just be indigestion or something. So should I go in my office or should I just head on down to the ER? Which way should I go? And so she's got a bat phone to the elders and they come swarming in. And the reality is it was nothing but pressure and anxiety. And I'm not an anxious person. Like I really don't get that worried. One of my favorite proverbs is Jimmy cracks corn and I don't care. All right. I love it. And yet, the pressure of this caring for the souls and being held accountable before an almighty God is a pressure and a pain. It is a crushing. So, you better get real serious about what fills and drains your tank. You should. One of the, Matt Carter, the lead pastor at the Austin Stone, a couple years ago, he walked me through this exercise that somebody walked him through. That if you look at your life like a tank that's filled or drained with energy, you should go to bed every single night tired. But when you get below tired and start to get into exhaustion, you've got some problems. And typically what happens after exhaustion is moral failure. And moral failure often is not about morality. It's often about burnout and exhaustion. And you need to get real serious about the things that fill up your tank and the things that drain your tank. And have conversations with the people in your life that matter most and can do something about it, about what fills you and what drains you. So, like I mentioned hunting before, man, that's a fill. I love it. I love to go. I feel closer to Jesus. I feel rested. I pray more. Those kinds of things. It doesn't just mean that good things fill you and bad things drain you. There's some very, very good things in your life that will drain your tank. Preaching is one for me. I love to preach. I think I was built to preach. I love preparing, but we do a bunch of services. I preach 3 live on Sunday, 1 on Thursday night, 3 live on Sunday. On Sunday afternoon, I am almost in a coma. Because when I preach, I spit a lot and get into it, and, you know, it's moderately delivered, exceptionally received, but I really enjoy myself, all right? And so at the end of it, man, that tank is pretty close to empty, and so I need some fills. Fun dad is a fill. Responsible parenting is a drain. Now, that doesn't mean that I can't be like, hey, babe, I don't need to responsibly parent because it's a drain on me. No, obviously you've got to do those things. But if you don't take a close account of that, then I'm telling you, the enemy he'll take advantage of it. He'll take advantage of it. And so if you want to be a great leader and lead great teams, you have to have the ability to endure pain. The third one is this. If you want to be a great leader and lead great teams, you've got to submit to spiritual authority. You've got to submit to spiritual authority. And I think if anybody needs to hear this, church planters need to hear this. Because the thing that will probably make you a great church planter is your rebellion against authority. For some of you, that's why you're planting. Because in your mind, you think nobody else can do it as good as me. So thank you, kingdom. Here I come. And so I want you to notice here. When the mother of the sons of Zebedee comes to ask Jesus, kind of for a favor, hey, can you promote my boys to senior VP right and left? And his answer is this, it is not mine to grant. Huh? Jesus has all authority under heaven and earth. Colossians 1 lets us know that all things were made by him, for him, through him, and to him. That it is his power that holds our very existence in orbit around the sun. And he goes, that's above my pay grade. He says, it is not mine to grant, but it is for those whom it has been prepared by my Father. Here's what this means. Even in the Godhead, there is mutual submission. Even in the Godhead, there is mutual submission. There's one God and 3 persons mutually submitted to one another in love. This is why 1 John 4 can tell us that God is love. That God is both the subject and object of God's love for God's self in mutual submission to God. And so Jesus says, it's not for mine to grant. And the reality is that we are all under authority. If you look at the org chart of the Church of 1122, the senior pastor of our church is Jesus. Senior pastor is a pretty good English translation of chief shepherd. And so Jesus took that title, so we're going to let him have it at our church. And then all the rest of us are under shepherds for the chief shepherd. Philippians chapter 2 lets us know that our attitude should be the same as that of Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped. Now listen, we live in a world right now, and I hope we're coming out of it. I hope we are. Especially in my world, like I said, I'm an Acts 29 guy. And so, especially in our little microcosm of church planting, for about a decade or so, people equated dominance with good leadership. And Jesus says here, hey, the Gentiles lord their authority over one another, and it shall not be so among you. So I would tell you this. Do not expect the Lord to give you any authority until you learn how to live under authority. This is what Jesus is saying here. Do not expect the Lord to give you any authority until you learn how to live under authority. That's why at the Church of 1122, we planted from under authority. I mean, listen, again, I was a, kind of a free agent youth guy at a Methodist church. I am not Methodist in any way, shape, or form. But it was a great church. It was teaching the Bible, and people were being, lives were being changed. And again, you know how youth pastors are. Give me a building and a budget, leave me alone. We'll work anywhere. That's kind of how we are. And then God put me under the senior pastor. His name's Jerry Sweat. And he's the most humble, caring, tender, priestly pastor I've ever met. I am none of those things. I mean, at all. And little did I know that what God was doing, my assistant just laughed out loud. Thanks, Carl. Okay. So, and when we had this service. And imagine how he feels. We had this service at his church that outgrows the church. So can you imagine the tension going on? You know what he didn't do? He didn't come in and be like, thanks, Scooter. I'll take that back now that it's all big and awesome. Okay. He never did that. He leveraged all the Methodist chips he had to go take it to that denomination and say, hey, I've got an idea. What if a United Methodist Church plants a non-denominational church? I don't think it's ever been done before. Okay. And so there's a big mega church in our town. And that guy heard that I was planting the church of 1122, and he called me and said, hey, can I take you to lunch? I said, sure. And so we go and we sit down, and we're literally across the street from the church I was on staff at that point. And he looked at me and he said, listen, you honor that pastor and you honor that church in this season, and the Lord will honor you in your season. The way you exit this season determines how you walk into the next season. And I felt like I was eating lunch with like Ezekiel or somebody, okay? Cool, you speak the word of the Lord, because that's not really my attitude. That's not the way I'm wired. And I had to surrender and submit that through the power of the gospel. I went back into the church I was on staff at, got my team. We walked through Philippians chapter 2 and said, listen, we will never be given authority until we learn how to live under authority. Philippians 2 says, treat others as if they're better than yourselves. So I said, as we're figuring out how we launch here, this is what we do. In every opportunity that you have, you bow lower than the church that is sending us. And so if you were under authority, I would ask you this. Are you criticizing or are you supporting your authority? Are you criticizing or are you supporting your authority? Because when you criticize the authority that God has placed over you, I hope you realize you are criticizing God. That in his sovereign grace, he picked your boss. Not some HR committee. That God Almighty picked your boss. And here's what your boss or the person over you wants to know. They need two things from you. They need to know that you think they have what it takes. That's the first thing. Now, again, nobody's perfect. God's also placed you in their life that iron could sharpen iron for sure. But fundamentally, they need to know that you think that they have what it takes. And then secondly, they need to know that you are on their team. And by the way, if you're not, and if you don't, then leave. One of the greatest things you could do for that church and for the kingdom of God is step out from under the authority if you cannot humble yourself under that authority. So they, again, they need to know that you think they have what it takes. And secondly, that you are on their team. If you remember in Matthew 16, where Jesus says to the disciples at Caesarea Philippi, so who do people say that I am? You know, and they give that weird list of, like, it's a reincarnation list, but some of them are alive at the same time, so I don't think they were that smart or they don't know how that works, you know what I mean? And then he's like, okay, so, but what about you? Who do you say that I am? And Peter says, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God. And then Jesus says, and you all know this, right? He says, hey, this is not your idea. This idea came from the Father, and your new name's Rocky, or the Rock, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And then the next thing he says is this, and I will give you the keys to the kingdom of heaven. I will give you the keys to the kingdom of heaven. And that's how the church is planted. And so, if you are in authority, my question for you is this. Are you trying to build your key ring, or are you trying to hand out keys to the kingdom of heaven? Because what Pastor Jerry Sweat did to me was, He saw someone submitted to the Christ, the Son of the living God, and he took one of the keys off the key ring that God had given him, passed down through authority, and handed it to me and said, all right, run with it. Which is what Jesus did at Caesarea Philippi when he first introduced the whole idea of church. That's why I think planting from under authority is super important. It's super important. So submit to spiritual authority is number three. And then the last one is this. I want to ask you this question. Do you see yourself as a leader who serves or as a servant that gets to lead? Those are two fundamentally different things. Do you see yourself as a leader who serves or a servant who gets to lead? Jesus says in verse 28, even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Another way, I'll say to our staff, I've been saying this a lot. We've got, our staff grew like crazy. We've got a really young staff. We've got a whole lot of people on staff that don't have any other church experience. It's a part of why we brought our whole staff to Expo. Because I just wanted them to see, kind of get a taste of what God's doing all over the kingdom and that every church plant doesn't go the way our church plant goes. And so one of the fundamental questions I'll ask our staff is this. Do you think that God created our church so that you would have a place to do ministry? Or do you think you were created to serve the bride of Christ here at our local church? Because those are two fundamentally different things. And man, I am all for things like strength finders and knowing your personality profile and understanding what your spiritual gifts are, etc. But the shadow of that that's happened in the last, I don't know, decade or so is that people know who they are so well, or they think they know who they are so well, that sometimes they think that the church and its ministry actually exist for them to have a place to exercise the rainbow, the Skittle, and the puppy's breath that they are. And it could not be further from the truth. That God actually created you to be a chief servant for the bride of Christ. And so, even if you think about it, we don't like to be servants. Unless it's an adjective to the kind of leader that we are. And we'll say that. Well, I'm a servant leader. But what we're really saying is I'm a leader. And what Jesus is saying, and he is the leader of leaders. King of kings, Lord of lords. And he says, I'm here to serve. And so, Ryan Britt, who's sitting in the back, we were talking about it on the way up here. And I was just kind of running through this part with him. And he said, a question that you have to ask is this. The people that work for you, do you really believe in your heart that they have more kingdom potential than you do? Or do you think they are just there to help you fulfill yours? You see the difference? I mean, the first time I began to go through this, I thought, oh my goodness, I have been completely working off of the wrong definition of great. That I've been trying to be great the way the world defines it. And Jesus says, if you want to be great, then you serve. So here's how this plays out in being a great leader of a great team. You've got to be more concerned about how your people are doing than what your people are doing. Which is a cool thing to say, unless you're lying. But you've got to be more concerned about how your folks are doing than what your folks are doing. Because if you can get the how right and the what's not going on, then they're just either not in the right place or they don't have the competency. And you can fix both of those very easily, very easily. Now, I'll just tell you this. Nobody wants to be an extra in your movie. Nobody wants to be an extra in the epic adventure of your church plant. They are the main character in their own epic. And your job as a great leader is to be an extra in theirs. It's to look for ways to hand over the keys of the kingdom of heaven. It's to bow yourself lower than the people that are helping you. And to serve, serve, serve. And this is a part of what Jesus means when he says that if you want to be first, then you'll be last. So kind of an idea, a concept that I've been toying around with lately that's been very convicting and kind of confessional for me is this, is that As we were planning the Church of 1122, and I'm digging through the scriptures, you know, one of the primary illustrations in the New Testament of leader is a shepherd, right? And you probably know this in Greek, the word for pastor and shepherd are the same word. They're the same word. And I begin to think, these guys don't have to use that illustration. There were lots of leadership illustrations in the first century. You could have gone athlete. You could have gone army general. But the most consistent one is this idea of shepherd. And yet, in our context, I think we have more cowboys than we do shepherds. Now, I'm not anti-cowboy. As you can tell by my accent, I'm country. There's a difference between country and cowboy, but they're like first cousins in the redneck family tree. You know what I mean? And by nature, I am a cowboy, not necessarily a shepherd. But as shepherds, we've been called to know our sheep. That's John 10, to know our sheep. And cowboys count the numbers of heads of cattle. I don't think any cowboy names the cows, right? He doesn't know the cow. He just knows how many there are. That a shepherd is called to protect the sheep. Isn't that Psalm 23? But a cowboy protects his investment. I mean, when the coyotes or the wolves come, he's not concerned about the individual cow. He's concerned about what's going to happen to me if something happens to that cow. Whereas Jesus tells us that a good shepherd would lay down his life for his sheep. The shepherds are to feed and care for their sheep. That's 2 Timothy 4, 2 through 7. And yet I think most cowboys, I think they fatten the cows so they have a greater return on their investment. The shepherds, this is the biggest one for me, that shepherds are called to love their sheep. To love their sheep. But I think cowboys just love being a cowboy. I mean, think about it. I mean, I don't know. But I don't know of any arena where there are shepherd games. Like where people dress up like shepherds and get shepherd sandals and a shepherd robe and a shepherd staff and go to a shepherd bar and, you know, tell shepherd stories. But there's this whole lifestyle and arena of cowboy, and you don't even have to be one. I mean, you can get cowboy boots and belt buckle and a cowboy hat and never own or know a cow. And rope and ride and listen to Toby Keith and do the whole cowboy thing that has nothing to do with cows. And here's what I think. I think there are a lot of us that love being a pastor more than we love people. But we've been called to be shepherds, not cowboys. That's a question you've got to really get down in there. And I know this is a conference, no place to be honest, but sometime before you go to bed tonight, you ask yourself, wow, do I just love this position and need to use these people for my position? Or has God positioned me to love and serve these people? And then the last one is the way a shepherd leads is a shepherd guides. A shepherd, by knowing and protecting and feeding and caring and loving, the shepherd goes first and says, follow me. And the sheep know his voice and they trust him and they follow after the shepherd's voice. And then a cowboy gets in the back of the herd and with a whole lot of noise and ruckus, he drives it and drives it and drives it to places they don't necessarily want to go. And so, are you a shepherd? Or a cowboy? Confession. I am by nature and nurture a cowboy. And was told for many, many years that that's what leadership looked like. The only problem with that would be the Bible. And that God has been continually transforming my heart in this sanctifying process. To hopefully lead me to understand his definition of being a great leader and leading a great team. Thanks. Any questions? We've got 10 minutes or so for questions.
Are you sure you're not about the Methodist?
I promise I am not a Methodist. If you would like to talk about the doctrines of grace, I'd be happy to, or TULIP, or any of those things. Yes, sir.
In your second point, you talked about the ability to endure pain.
Yes, sir. Yeah, man, ministry is a family event. It just is. There's been a bunch of people that have tried to keep that thing separate and draw, in my opinion, a false dichotomy between caring for your family and being effective in your church. But when the two become one, man, it's an all skate in there. And so my wife, for example, my wife's grandfather planted the church that she grew up in. Okay, and her mother, my mother-in-law, played organ and piano and all of that sort of thing. And it was a smaller country church in the mountains of Virginia. And so she saw her parents and grandparents live with this pressure, because the way that the ecclesiology of that church was set up is that everything was decided by congregational vote. So literally on any Sunday, if enough of the congregation could get together and vote out her granddad, they could be gone. And so even though in our church, that's not how we're set up at all, there is still this residual pressure that my wife puts on herself to live up to this expectation that she has as to what a lead pastor's wife is supposed to be. And that pressure equals pain. It just, no matter how many times I let her know, no, you don't have to be at everything, and you don't have to. And she's one of our singers on our worship team. And if she ever just wants to take a day off, like this last weekend, we just gotten back from vacation. I went to church on Sunday. She took the kids to breakfast. Somebody saw her at wherever they were eating breakfast and was like, why aren't you in church? And that may sound like a little thing. Again, to me, I'm like, because I don't want to be. No problem, all right? Don't ask me stuff like that again. And so, but for her, it just equals pressure, and that pressure equals pain. And so my job is to cultivate the kind of environment where she can blossom into everything that God had called and created her to be. And my job, if you remember what Adam got in trouble for, God said, hey, listen, you're in trouble because you listened to the voice of your wife. And every husband's like, does that mean we're not supposed to listen to the voice of our wife? Correct. You're supposed to listen to her heart. Because what she says doesn't always match up with her heart. You know how I know? Because when your wife tells you she's fine, she ain't fine. Right? And so your job is to cultivate that and set those expectations in your church. There was somebody that I kicked out of our church because they were critical that my wife worshiped with no shoes on a few times. I was like, great, then you're not coming here anymore. And it's like, no, whatever. Get out. Don't ever show up here again. No problem. So it really is your responsibility to manage. And the thing I'm trying to figure out right now is, I was talking about this with a few staff members on the way up, is how do I best communicate to my kids, like, why I'm gone this week? And so I think those are healthy conversations that great teams should have together, and that church staffs could come up with language for families that help children understand why mom and dad can't be there this week and how it is a part of kingdom advancement and what place the kids will play in that. Does that make sense? As opposed to drawing this false dichotomy that every time you go off to do church stuff, somehow you don't love me as much anymore. And so we're working through, literally right now, a lot of us on staff have similar age children. And so we're working through language that best communicates that to our children. Because I know some pastor kids that they feel like they were partnering with their parents in ministry even when they were like in elementary school. And so we're trying to figure out how to do that to alleviate some of that pain. Anything else? Yes, sir. So it was not with the intention of planting a church. It was really just to reach that gap generation. We had a bunch of teenagers. We had a bunch of like over 40 feeling frisky kind of people. You know, we had a sort of a Willow Creek model with about 100 instruments and band people and motions to songs. And, you know, and so people in their 20s and 30s weren't coming. And so that was kind of the motivation from my boss. But I didn't want to start an age-graded service. Because I just thought the concentration of 20-year-olds in one place, that concentration of ignorance just scared me to death. And so we had traditional services at that church. And so I calmed our traditional services and asked all the older people to please come and be a missionary on their own campus. And just love college students and that sort of thing. And so it was not the intention whatsoever. And at first it was we were all going to do this together as a team. But follow we just doesn't work. So after about 3 months, the first few weeks went okay, and then it almost died. And I had some people on my team say, you have to take this thing over. And I can't do anything a little bit. So I went to my leadership and said, it's either all got to be mine or I'm getting all the way out. I don't care, because I could totally go back to youth ministry and love it. And so they gave me the reins. And then from that point, there was a whole lot of autonomy. And looking back, we were really operating as a church within a church. We just didn't know that yet. And then, by the grace of God, my senior pastor is a godly man and saw the kingdom win and allowing that to happen and then launching us. I do think, honestly, looking back, I think it's a great way to plant a church. And the reason is because on opening weekend of your church plant, you know how to do the most important thing really well, which is the weekend service. So we didn't have to spend a whole lot of time on the weekend production stuff. It was the only thing that we knew how to do. Now, what we had to figure out to do was like insurance and parking and kids and all of that other stuff. So that was our story. Yes, sir. Last one. We're a Reformed church all the way. And so I think the sovereign graces of God are, well, the preeminence of Christ, the firstness of God, that he is first, is really the foundation of church life and family life and the doctrines of grace and salvation. And it really drives all that we do, that God is the initiator and we are the responders. And so it drives the way we worship, the way we pray, the way we give, the way we make decisions. And so I would say it's foundational to everything we do. Cool. All right. Hey, thanks so much for being here. I hope it was helpful. I'll be here till the very end. If you've got any questions, we'd love to be able to serve you and help you any way we can. Thanks.